Today's sermon is the penultimate message of this long Bible study series, second to last message of this long Bible study series on the subject of the Abrahamic covenant. Please turn to Hebrews chapter 11. And last time, in part 16, we finished with the first half of Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 16. And if you remember, we were talking about the difficulties or the possible difficulties for Abraham and his extended family, the difficulty that they probably had in leaving the city-state of Ur of the Chaldees, the prosperous, affluent city-state of Ur. So let's back up a couple of verses just to pick up the context. Please turn to Hebrews 11 and verse 15, please. Hebrews 11, verse 15. And truly, if they, Abraham and his family, had called to mind that country, which was Ur, that country which they had come out, they would have had the opportunity to return. But as we saw last time, Abraham and his family did not take the advantage of that opportunity to return to the relative comfort of Ur. Verse 16, but now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. So we know that God certainly did provide a better physical country, or countries actually, for Abraham's progeny. But he, Abraham, and they came to more deeply desire the ultimately better country. In fact, the best country. In fact, the heavenly country. Not the kingdom in heaven, as we know, but the kingdom of heaven, right here on earth. We're going to be talking about that on the Feast of Trumpets coming up. The kingdom of heaven, right here on earth. Not just a country, but also a very special city as well. Second half of verse 16. Therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. God is not ashamed to be called their God. Now, we can be sure that God would be ashamed to be called the God of a family, or a people, or a church, who are only interested in the earthly, in the physical. But because Abraham and his family came to desire his heavenly country even more than any earthly physical country, he's not ashamed of them. He's not ashamed of them. Or at least he was not ashamed of them. Past tense. But if we look at Abraham's progeny today, I'm sure that God must be ashamed of today's hedonistic, backsliding peoples of the modern Israelite nations. And as a result of that, we cannot be surprised, we should not be surprised, that as Paul told us in Romans chapter 11, you don't need to turn there, we went through it in detail a couple of months ago, we cannot be surprised that God has given physical Israel a spirit of stupor. He's given them eyes that they shouldn't see and ears that they shouldn't hear to this very day. He's made their table and their recompense to be a snare and a trap and a stumbling block. He's darkened their eyes. He's blinded them so that they cannot see. He's bowed down their backs in spiritual slavery. And that spiritual slavery is likely soon in the end times to become physical slavery. He's caused them to stumble, and he has temporarily cast them away from himself. That's physical Israel. But what about us in spiritual Israel? Could God be ashamed of any of us? Are any of us more interested in the physical trappings of the world today than in the better country of the world tomorrow? If we are, God will judge us, and he'll judge us by the very same set of rules that he judged physical Israel. Do you want him to be ashamed of you? I'm sure you don't. I'm sure I don't want him to be ashamed of me. So because, and I'm repeating now, because of the faith of Abraham and his family, and because they sought and desired a better country, the best country, not only has God prepared a better country for them, he's even prepared, as we said, a special city for them. And I'm pretty sure that that special city is twofold. First of all, we think about the physical Jerusalem that will, we believe, is going to be transformed and rebuilt in the millennium after the return of Jesus Christ. And secondly, the new Jerusalem, so much better, so much more wonderful than the even physical Jerusalem and in all of its glory. This amazing holy city that's going to come down from God at the end of the millennium, and that's described in the 21st and 22nd chapters of Revelation. You don't have to turn there now. We'll leave that discussion of that. We're going to be talking about that a lot during the feast and on the last great day. But let's move on. Still in Hebrews chapter 11 now, verse 17. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, in Isaac your seed shall be called. That's a quotation from Genesis chapter 21. Now this verse here says that Abraham had received the promises. Now, I'm not a real Greek scholar, but I looked up the tense for had received there, and it's called a Greek aorist tense, aorist tense, and it actually comes out as a simple past tense in the English. But it doesn't mean that the covenant promises had all been actually fulfilled during Abraham's physical lifetime. It doesn't mean that. It means merely that Abraham had received the promises verbally from God. He hadn't got all the benefits from them yet, just the promises for the future. And this is very significant because, and as Abraham was going through that great trial with his son, having to being told to sacrifice his son, I'm sure that Abraham asked God at that time, that if Isaac was dead, he wouldn't be able to sire any children. So if he couldn't sire any children, how could he receive the promise of seed, either race, physical, or grace, spiritual? And God had specifically promised those things would come through Isaac. And the answer is in verse 19. Abraham here concluding that God was able to raise him, Isaac, up even from the dead, from which he, Abraham, also received him in a figurative sense. So now we have hindsight, 2020 vision. So we know now, in hindsight, that God sent an angel to stop Abraham actually killing Isaac. But the point is that with the help and the strength of his God-given faith, Abraham was willing to do it. And the deed was as good as done when he raised that knife. So now, Abraham did have great faith. We know that. He was the father of the faithful. But please remember, it was grounded. Abraham's faith was firmly grounded on solid experience, as well as in other instances, especially though through the humanly impossible birth of Isaac. Abraham and Sarah had witnessed the faithfulness of God firsthand, over and over again, absolutely proving to them that God always follows through on his promises, always follows through on his promises perfectly. So through Abraham's exercise of his great God-given faith, he likely assumed that if he went ahead and killed Isaac, in order for God's unbreakable promises to be fulfilled, that God would physically resurrect Isaac at some point, and so that the promised covenant lineage could continue. Verse 20. And here the author of the book of Hebrews then moves on with the covenant story through Abraham's progeny. Verse 20, by faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. So this phrase, things to come. And I went to the library and I got the book by H.G. Wells, Things to Come, out of the library, and I started to read it, but it was a little bit weird, so I cast it off. But I'm sure that he got that phrase from this scripture, things to come. By faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau. The blessings mentioned here in this verse were the passing on of the covenant blessings, the wonderful things to come, primarily through Jacob, but also secondarily and very secondarily through Esau. Although Isaac's blessing on Esau is a very dubious one, if you continue to look at the scriptures about what happened to Esau and the promises and prophecies concerning Esau. Please bookmark the book of Hebrews and let's take a quick look at Genesis 27. Please bookmark Hebrews 11. We'll come back there in a minute. Let's go to Genesis 27. Genesis 27. Verse 38, Genesis 27, verse 38. And Esau said unto his father, have you but one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, my father. And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. And Isaac his father answered and said unto him, behold, your dwelling shall be the fatness of the earth, and of the dew of heaven from above. And by your sword shall you live, and shall serve your brother. And read this, and it shall come to pass, when you shall have the dominion, that you shall break his yoke from off your neck. Read that again. It shall come to pass, when you shall have the dominion, that you shall break his yoke from off your neck. We have to wonder, we look at world news, and we have to wonder if this last prophecy is beginning to come to pass right now. However, in the end time prophecies of Jeremiah, Amos, and Zechariah, don't need to turn to any of those, although the descendants of Jacob were very wayward, and still are wayward, they're still repeatedly referred to in those prophecies of as the only son. They're considered God, Yahweh of the Old Testament, the Lord of the Old Testament, considered them as his beloved only son when it comes to the pouring out of the blessings from the Abrahamic covenant. Although we can be pretty sure that Esau will likely be involved in end time events, without doubt the Abrahamic covenant was passed down through Jacob only, and Esau was never included in those blessings. Because he despised his birthright, God disqualified him and rejected him from receiving any of the Abrahamic covenant promises. Again, if you do a study on that, you'll find that there are other Old Testament prophecies that are even harsher condemnations of Esau, and even harsher prophecies for Esau for the future. Don't want to get into them today. So again, the Abrahamic covenant was passed down through Jacob only. And then what? Let's go back to Hebrews 11, please. Back to Hebrews 11. And continuing in verse 21. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshipped leaning on the top of his staff. We know from other scriptures in the book of Genesis there, I think it's in chapter 49, and we went through those in detail there, that the blessings were pronounced on all 12 of Jacob's sons. And those blessings that are mentioned there and listed there, they were much more than just wishful thinking, much more than mere deathbed hopes that things would turn out well for Jacob's sons and descendants. They were prophecies. They were solid prophecies that were given by God through the mouth of the fading Jacob. And those blessings varied, certainly did vary in value from son to son. The Abrahamic covenant grace blessings, and some of the race blessings as well, including the scepter and the crown and the throne, were passed down through Judah. And the lion's share of the race blessings were passed down through all of the tribes, and say with some reductions for some truncations, if you like, for Levi and Simeon and possibly Dan, but primarily were passed down through Joseph and his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and it mentions it right there in that verse. A certain limited fulfillment of the race promises was fulfilled even while Jacob's children and grandchildren, etc., were still in Egypt. Yet, even during the time that they were in Egyptian captivity, because there was one, and I've said this before, there was one of God's commands that Jacob's children and grandchildren were very adept at obeying. They were fruitful, and they multiplied, and their numbers grew like Topsy, much to the concern of their Egyptian captors. We know that that's being reversed now, and the children of Esau and the children of Ishmael are rising up in numbers, while our Israelite numbers are dwindling. That's another story. So, after 400 odd years in Egypt, God raised up another servant, another very special and faithful servant, but this time not of the primary covenant tribes of Judah, Ephraim, or Manasseh, but of the priestly tribe of Levi. Jump down to verse 24, please, still in Hebrews 11, verse 24. By faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Good reason for that, because he was the son of the Israelite priestly tribe of Levi. Verse 26, esteeming the reproach of Christ. Notice that, the reproach of Christ. Greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. Just as Abraham cast the relative comforts of Ur behind himself, and he sought in front of himself in the future, he sought a city, a country, a homeland, and all of else that God promised him for the future. But also, he sought the relatively difficult road to achieve those goals, to access those goals. In the same way as Abraham did that, in the same way Moses cast the comforts of his royal position in Egypt behind himself. Once Christ had given him the clear vision of a future reward. And again, we notice the word Christ there. And we know that it was Yahweh who did that. We know it was the Lord. And so a side point in that is that this is another solid proof that Jesus Christ was the Lord and the Yahweh of the Old Testament. The Lord and Yahweh of Moses' time. Verse 27, by faith he, talking about Moses still, he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, Pharaoh of course, for he, Moses, endured as seeing him who is invisible. So just like Abraham, Moses patiently endured the hardships of the road. In Moses' case, it was coming out of Egypt, going through the wilderness for 40 years on the way to the promised land of Canaan. I like to call it the initial promised land, because there was a much better promised land in the future. And also, just like Abraham, Moses never got to enjoy the initial race blessings of the initial promised land. He never got into there. Moses only had a brief glimpse of the promised land from up on Mount Nebo. So, same as Abraham. Abraham only had a little glimpse of what it was like. He went in and God pushed him out again. No, said, keep going. And just like Abraham, Moses was able to see with his mind's eye the invisible God. Wonderful examples, and the fact that these two men were so alike in many of their experiences. Okay, please jump down, still in Hebrews 11, down to verse 39. Looking back on all of the heroes of faith who were mentioned there, verse 39, and all these having obtained a good report, and that's that word martyrio that we talked about last time, having obtained a good report through faith, did not receive the promise. not one, brethren, not one of these great heroes of faith listed here in Hebrews 11, not one of them received the total fulfillment of the full Abrahamic covenant promises. Not one of them. Not Abel, not Enoch, not Noah, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, Esau, Joseph, Ephraim, Manasseh, Moses, and not even those who are listed in the other verses there, verses 30 to 32, we won't read them now, but those who were blessed to be able to live in the initial promised land of Israel. Joshua, Rahab, Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, Samuel, none of them. Yes, their population had mushroomed, just as God had promised it would. And yes, God had led them into this wonderful land of milk and honey, just as he promised. But although those two fulfillments might seem huge to us, they were only two relatively small parts of the promised reward of the Abrahamic covenant. There was more to come, much more. We'll read about that in a minute. Just want to point out, not even David, a man after God's own heart, received everything that God had in store for them and has in store for us. Again, there was much more to come. Verse 40. God, having provided something better, and there's that Greek word kreton again, kreton, God having provided something better for us, okay, this is the man who wrote the book of Hebrews, God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. So when he says they, he's talking about all of these heroes of faith that are listed in Hebrews 11 should not be made perfect apart from us. Talking about the man who wrote the book of Hebrews, the letter to the Hebrews, and all of his fellow church members at that time. The Israelites' population explosion and the verdant but tiny land of milk and honey certainly were very wonderful blessings. But again, there was something better to come, something much better to come. Okay, but looking at it from the time of the writing of this letter, okay, looking to the future from there, there was the extended physical race blessing of the inheritance of the beautiful lands of Canada, the United Kingdom, Ireland, Western Europe, the United States, New Zealand, Australia. Were these the something better that the Hebrews author was referring to here? Maybe. But it's so only very partially, because you have to look at this logically. This verse 40, you have to look at it logically. The Hebrews writer and his fellow church members of his lifetime, those he referred to here as us, they did not live to see the gifts of the modern Israelitish real estate that we have seen in Canada, the United States, and England, and these other places. These were a deferred extension, if you will, of the Abrahamic covenant race blessings. And of course, neither did their predecessors, the heroes of faith, who were all dead by that time, and nor did any of the other dead in Christ of the biblical era. They never saw all this. So we think about, remember Mr. Armstrong's old booklet there, the the United States and British Commonwealth in prophecy. Fantastic blessings that we've seen for the last 50, 100, 150, 200 years. He said that we're all going to see it together. So what was the something better that was mentioned here? And again, without even moving out of verse 40, the author of the letter to the Hebrews gives the answer right here. And that something better is being made perfect. It's perfection. This something better, this being made perfect, is something that all generations of God's people will receive together. And we can say virtually together anyway, because it might be for those, the difference between those who are dead at the return of Jesus Christ or were dead and are resurrected, they're going to be raised first, as we know, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and 1 Corinthians 15, that maybe a couple of split seconds apart between their resurrection and our change, assuming that we'll still be alive, which we may not be. The return of Jesus Christ and the first resurrection and the beginning of the millennium and the calling and the conversion of the physical human beings who will still be alive during the millennium, they will be the very next stages of the fulfillment of the grace part of the Abrahamic covenant. Godspeed that day, brethren. And we're going to be in the Feast of Tabernacles. That's what we're going to be looking forward to. That's what we're going to be talking about during the feast. The good news, the gospel, the true gospel of Jesus Christ. Okay, let's look at Hebrews 12. We'll just going to dip into Hebrews chapter 12 for today. Chapter 12 begins with God, through the author of the book of Hebrews, giving the readers of that letter, and that includes us, giving us a series of instructions of what we must do on our side of the covenant agreement. We know what he's going to give us, and we want to be there. It's not salvation by works, I'm not saying that. But there are certain things that we need to do on our side of the covenant agreement in order to receive its wonderful blessings. So, initially, I won't go through the whole thing. We'll read through the verses, the first 15 verses, then I'll give you a summary list of instructions that are given here by our loving God. So, Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 1. Wherefore, seeing we are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, and the Greek word is martyrs, and this doesn't mean, okay, so they're a cloud of witnesses. It doesn't mean to say that they're sitting in heaven right now looking down. I was reading a commentary this morning about these verses, and of course, being a Protestant writer, you know, he thinks that they're all up there in heaven now looking down on us and cheering us on. You know, they're not, they're dead, you know. But they are a cloud of witnesses. They are our examples. So they are the heroes of faith that are talked about, are listed in chapter 11. And it's just saying that they are these wonderful, great examples of faith for us. Okay, continuing in verse 1. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. Set before us, brethren, by God. And he continues in this vein all the way through here. Like, God is the coach and we're the runners in this race. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest you be wearied and faint. Not necessarily in your bodies like a runner would be, but in your minds. You have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. And you have forgotten the exhortation. And the exhortation is actually quoted from Proverbs chapter 3. The exhortation which speaks unto you as unto children. My son, despise not the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when you are rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the father chastens not? But if you be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then are you illegitimate, I'm going to use that other word, and not sons. Furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live? For they verily for a few days chastened us after their own pleasure, but he for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. Now, no chastening for the present seems to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. Wherefore lift up the hands which hang down, and the feeble knees. It's actually a quote from Job and from Isaiah. The feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. Follow peace with all men, and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. Looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled. So, the what's being described here, it's like, in a way, it's like the pep talk of an athletics coach, and then it seems to roll over into a father disciplining his children, and then it comes back to the athletics coach again. So it's like an athletics coach who's helping his team's runners to train for the big race, training them to run and to win that race. And in our case, for every single one of us, this is the most important race ever. So I'm going to give you now, I'll give you my own paraphrase of what is being said here. And this is what I believe that our coach, our wonderful coach, God in heaven, is what he's telling us, New Covenant runners, what we have to do on our side of the New Covenant. Number one, that we have to run with patience. We have to run that race. And we're not running, I'm not running against Trish, I'm not running against Fred, you're not running against me. We're all running the race. We're all going to get to that finish line, and we're all going to get the prize. But we've got to run. We've got to participate. Our heavenly coach has entered us into that race, and we can't give up on it. We've got to keep on going. Number two, we have to strive against sin. It says we have to lay aside every sin. We have to lay aside every unnecessary energy sapping weight, any pursuit or any activity that can slow us down and impede our progress. Number three, we have to keep looking at those heroes of faith and their examples, their wonderful examples. All of them great examples, but more especially to the example of Jesus Christ, our elder brother, because he is the author and the finisher of our faith, and he's our forerunner, and he's our pace setter. He's the one who sets the pace. We can't keep up with him. We'd love to be able to keep up with him, but we know we can't, but we've got to try. He's our pace setter, and he's a forerunner. He's done it. He's already made it across the finish line. So we look to him and say, you did it. We know we can't be as good as you, but we're going to cross that finish line too. Got to do that. Number four, we're going to be faced, in this race, we're going to be faced with resistance. We're going to be faced with hardships. Just running itself is, I don't do much running anymore. Used to, but even then I didn't like it. Just the resistance of your own body. You go up a little bit of a hill, got the resistance of that hill. We're on like a race course. And the resistance and the hardships of our spiritual race course are the world, the flesh, and the devil. But what God through this author is telling us to do here is to treat these hardships, these resistances, like spiritual exercise. Spiritual exercise. And that if we emulate the endurance of Jesus, he who endured so many sinful contradictions against himself, the world, the Jews, Satan, resisted what Jesus was doing, what he was trying to do. But he endured. He didn't give up. He kept going. Number five, don't allow yourself to become spiritually weary or faint. We all get physically tired. We all sometimes get mentally tired. But spiritually, we keep studying God's word in the Bible every day. We keep that contact with God the Father in prayer every day. He won't let us become spiritually weary or faint. We need to, this number six, heed the exhortation of our coach, the exhortations of our coach that he gives to his beloved team of runners. The runners, again, who he has entered into this Christian race. We didn't volunteer, we didn't say, I'm going to go into this race. He called every one of us, said, I want you on my team. Number seven, we are to be in total subjection to him. Number eight, we are not to despise his loving chastening or rebuke against. Again, when we run into trials, and we all do, we're all getting older. We've all got our own thorns in the flesh, physical problems. Think of them as just parts of our spiritual exercise program, and endure them without fainting. Number nine, build spiritual muscle and strength, again, by making spiritual exercise a daily priority in overcoming, but again, with prayer and study every day. Number 10, don't neglect our fellow runners. We need to help one another. And especially those who perhaps have become weak or faint or weary. Help to lift up any hands which you see hanging down. Help strengthen any knees which have become feeble. And again, we're not just talking about physically, we're talking about spiritually and mentally. And we have a responsibility in love for one another. Number 11. Don't become lame ourselves. Beware of becoming lame. And if any of us have become lame, again, we're talking about spiritually, we need to seek the spiritual healing from our loving coach. And again, because he cares so much for every one of us, he cares about our progress and he cares about our well-being. He really does. Number 12. We have to maintain the straight spiritual path. And Satan is going to try and, he's going to throw crooked, time-wasting, energy-sapping paths. He's going to try and make us think that these things that he throws in our way are shortcuts. We have to refuse to be turned out of the way. We have to refuse to be turned away from the race course that we know to be the correct one. May not be the easiest. Might be easier to go around the hill than to go over it. But if that's the way he wants us to go, we've seen too many brethren look for the easy way. And it's not the answer. Number 13. Keep the prize in mind, in our mind's eye, like Abraham did, like Moses did. Pursue the race's prize. And again, there's one for every one of us. We don't have to nudge each other out of the way. We don't have to do that. We've all got that prize ahead of us, as long as we don't give up. And the prizes are fantastic. And he mentions some of them here. He talks about holiness. Earlier we were talking about perfection. And perfection and holiness go hand in hand. And peace. So it says, pursue peace with everyone. That is, like, peace is it's a prize in itself. Pursue peace with everyone. Both our brethren, the called, and the not yet called. We don't have to, we have brethren and other, we got brethren who keep the feast at different times now, we have brethren in that group and brethren in that group and brethren. We don't have to fight with them. We don't have to call them down. We don't have to keep disagreeing with them. Because if we do, we can get a root of bitterness. And we've got to avoid that. So, number 14, don't allow any root of bitterness to trouble or defile us. He says that in there. Not against any of our fellow runners. Not against any on who might even be on what we might think of as an opposing team. Our brethren in other church groups are not on an opposing team. They're on God's team as well. He knows who his people are. It's not our job to say, they're a bunch of bad guys, and we're the only ones who are doing what is right. No. God will sort all of that out. So don't allow a root of bitterness. And then finally, another repetition of an exhortation that we've been given a few times in previous parts of this series. Number 15, look diligently. Seek diligently. Again, keep our eyes on the finish line. Just imagine the winner's podium, and there's not going to be like a bronze and a silver and a gold in the middle. Is a goal for every one of us. So keep our eyes on that goal. The receiving of the prize, and it's what we've talked about throughout this series is the blessings and the promises and the rewards of the Abrahamic covenant and of the new covenant. So we seek those things diligently, keep them in your mind's eye, but also we need to diligently seek and search out the things that are going to get us there, going to get us to that point. So brethren, going to keep it short for today. We're going to take a short break from our Abrahamic covenant topic. We've got the Feast of Trumpets coming up, and then we've got the Day of Atonement, and then after the Day of Atonement on October the 24th we'll be back in Parksville just before the Feast of Tabernacles, and that'll be part 18. It'll be the finale of this long Bible study series, so that will be in 2 weeks' time.